Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Richie Neal, talk to me about one of my favorite places in the world, Ireland. I love that country, and it's just amazing how much you know and have had to do with all of it. Anything interesting going on? The taxi cab driver in Galway that we had a year ago told us that he was once a millionaire, but now he hasn't got any money. His house is not worth what it was before. Ireland has had a very tough time. Are they coming back?
They're coming back. As you know, they've adopted the rigid austerity. And as part of that austerity program, many might argue that it's slowed growth. Others would say by getting your budget balanced in this particular time that you're going to prepare yourself for more growth once the economy turns. But they have the same problem that we've had, and that is the real estate market. People were buying $500,000 houses that are now worth $150,000. And having trouble when the layoffs came along, even making the payments on those mortgages. So I think that hurt them seriously. They're back to very high immigration rates, which is troubling only because one of the things that the Celtic Tiger did, it allowed them to stay and grow on the island. And Ireland, as you know, since the Great Famine, has exported its people in record numbers. It was a nation of 8 million people before the Great Famine, or the Irish phrase, "O Gach Mór." And then after a million died and a million immigrated, their population never really grew. Today, there is population growth, but people are immigrating again. And I think that the peace process in the north has held. There are some minor hiccups, but I think that's worked very well. But I think one of the reasons that you're attracted to Ireland is because of their writers. I mean, when you consider that Yeats and Joyce are but two, Brendan Behan and others, Jonathan Swift, all of these writers, and they had a great affection for the written and spoken word. And I think that that scholarship that they embraced has made it still a great center of learning, and the people in Ireland are all literate. And they don't sit in rural areas and watch a lot of TV other than sporting events because they engage conversation. And the economy, I think, because the population is so well-educated, it's going to recover in time. The question is, will they be able to get those people back who are now leaving again in droves?
Interesting. What about religion? We see the election of a new pope. And I know that, you know, the church was once really all-powerful. Has that changed?
It's changed substantially. There was an argument to be made that at one time, I think, that Ireland was a theocracy. And it's very clear now that that has changed dramatically. There have been the same problems and scandals that have arisen there that have arisen in other nations. But there are critics who would say that Éamon de Valera, who was one of the great figures in Irish history, that he was able to embed in the Constitution state-supported religion. And that has changed. If you recall, there was a time when you could not be divorced on the island. You could not get a divorce on the island. Abortion was outlawed. And today, that's all changed. And the people that were very devout and brought that devotion to America, they are not quite as strong in their devotion. And I think much of it has to do with the way some of these problems have been handled. And I don't think that you can understate the seriousness of how these problems were handled. And I also think that it's
the problems meaning that, sexual abuse.
Yes, and I think that, you know, there should be no apologizing. Criminality is criminality. And when these efforts were made to move these individuals around, I think it ill-served the church, and I think it certainly ill-served the people. And today, you can see the consequences that Ireland is not like some other European countries. Poland, for example, where devotions are still very, very high. But Ireland has become a bit more like France and Great Britain as time has moved along.
You were instrumental in the Irish peace accords, Richie Neal. So my question to you is, every once in a while you see a little something happen that is quite disturbing, and you say, uh-oh, maybe we're in for it again. What's your report to us about how it's all going?
Well, you now have 1.5 generations that have grown up without the violence. So there are hiccups. There are some still sectarian beatings that have taken place. But the tenets of the Good Friday Agreement have held. There is a government that's up and running. It's become a model for conflict resolution. Israelis and Palestinians, South Africans and Bedouins and others visit to see what the important ingredients were in that successful conclusion to the Good Friday Agreement. You have British prime ministers that now take to the floor of Commons and they apologize for the famine, they apologize for sectarian murders that were committed, assassinations that they utilized their military to undertake. And there's still a couple of big cases that are lingering that we continue to pursue here. But the idea that a British prime minister would acknowledge that the Bloody Sunday event was blatant murder, the British prime minister that would apologize for the famine, a British prime minister that would apologize again for sectarian murder, that's a huge step in the right direction. So reconciliation has been the path forward, and there are men and women of goodwill, and I've heard many ministers and priests and religious and lay people say that we'll achieve our goal when we no longer talk about two communities, but instead we'll talk about one community with two traditions.
Richie Neal, tell me about gun reform. You know, in New York State, Andrew Cuomo got his, quote, SAFE Act through. I know that Barack Obama has called for a similar measure nationally. Can it happen?
I think it can happen. I think that the president has staked out some sound positions. And I think it's important to note that we're not going to get everything we want in terms of being absolute. But I do think that you can secure some marginal victories here. As you know, even in the Senate yesterday, a committee passed legislation for stronger background checks. What I think you need here are a series of steps to build confidence between the two sides. One side being able to argue, look, we're not trying to take your guns away, but we do think that mental health checks and background checks are very important. And if we can't get to an assault weapons ban, which I have voted for in the past in favor, then that still doesn't mean that we can't achieve some changes in what has now become an epidemic of gun violence. And remember that it was that assault weapon where each one of those children in Newtown was shot at least three times. That could not have happened if the assault weapon were not available.
You represented Springfield, of course. You were mayor. What would this change if we were really able to put some of these into effect? What would it mean to a city like Springfield?
Well, I think it would take away, I mean, these random shootings that you've seen, these drive-bys. There is a market where straw purchases are made, and these kids are able to access guns. And many times these weapons are used on other neighborhood kids and with these posses and these gangs that have been developed. And in Pittsfield, I've talked to Mayor Bianchi about it, and they have the same problem. And he's talked to me extensively about who has weaponry in the city. And the police chief and others, we've talked about it again quite aggressively. The problem is that these guns have fallen into the hands of very young people, sometimes 14 to 15 or 16, and they're using them for gang violence. So I've always questioned the need for a concealable handgun, because I think that it causes havoc in big cities on Saturday nights.
We only have less than 2 minutes, and I'm sorry for doing this to you, but drones, a lot of people write to us and say, why do we need the drones, and why is Obama doing this? What do you think?
Well, I think that transparency is the issue, and I think having a better understanding of what constitutionally an American president can do to order the assassination, perhaps, of an American citizen. And I must tell you, just in my own instance, I approved of Obama getting Iwaliki. He was destined to create more travesty here in America, and he was going to clearly try to kill American citizens. He was committed to a jihad against America, so I give the president some latitude on that one. I think the problem is that if you witnessed it, the Justice Department has had some difficulty in explaining the constitutional justification for the application of the drone. And I think clearing that up would be very helpful. But remember, and we can't get away from it, the number one responsibility of the federal government of the United States is to provide for the security of its people. And I think that the president, in the case of Iwaliki, acted correctly.
Richie Neal, always a great pleasure to have you with us. I know I'm not supposed to say this, but you are so smart.
Well, thank you.
And you always teach us something. Thanks again, Richie.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Alan. Be well.